Ladies and gentlemen, break the knobs off your radios, shut off your televisions, but turn up the volume on your smartphones and MP3 players. For the next 30 minutes, you will experience a blackout. Welcome to the show that gives you news commentary from a black male perspective. Do you know what time it is?
What is up, everybody? It is Dr. Vibe, host and producer of Do You Know What Time It Is? I'm also host and producer of the award-winning The Dr. Vibe Show. As always, I like to say you're blessed, highly favored, a magnet for miracles, and a solution for someone's problem. Don't worry, that's not someone coming for me, but someone may be coming for one of our panelists after tonight's conversation. So, and I have a feeling who it may be for, but I'm not going to put my guess out there. We all know who it's going to be for sure. I am host and producer of Do You Know What Time It Is? Also host and producer of the award-winning Dr. Vibe Show. Again, you're blessed, highly favored, a magnet for miracles, and a solution for someone's problem. If you don't know what it is we're doing, or if you do know, it is Do You Know What Time It Is? Weekly show, most of the time, every Sunday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Get a group of black men together. I share some articles with them, and they give their commentary on it. On them, or each one of them. Last week, I took a week off. Yes, I'm allowed to do that because it's my show. Thank you very much. And I said, though, tonight, coming back, and usually I give 4 or 5 stories for the gentleman to come on. Tonight, we got 6 because, I mean, over the last 2 weeks, there's so much happening. Even up to last night, there was stuff happening. I had to slip in a conversation piece for the gentleman on this platform tonight. So, first things first, let's do what we like to say. Let's do a roll call. And let's start off with the man from Denver. He has not been on for a few weeks because we just call him AKA Mr. Deadline. I think the deadline is he's trying to find a good quarterback for his NFL team. But that's enough.
I was in the crowd last night.
Okay.
Sports Authority Field. And so had a good time, was able to get out this weekend.
Good stuff.
But good evening, everybody. It's good to be back with you. And yes, I've been on a number of deadlines here lately, and still on one tonight. I wanted to make sure that I got back with you. I can't take too much time without fellowshipping with you guys. I just want you to know that. Anyway, this is Dr. Alfonso Porter in Denver, Colorado. I'm the managing partner of Vertex Learning, where we specialize in helping you get your book out of your head and into the marketplace. We also want to help you become a highly sought after, highly paid expert speaker in your genre or niche. Alfonso Porter.
Nice. Good stuff. Next up, we have Galen Bingham.
Hey, Dr. Vibe. And I am so excited to be with all you guys. This is Galen Bingham. I am a multifaceted 25-year veteran of corporate America, a leadership strategist, an executive coach, an author, and a small business owner. With Leadership Residue, I specialize in helping motivated leaders deliver lasting results and inspiration that remains even beyond their physical existence. And I am really, really excited about all the topics and all the articles that you've got for us this week.
Thank you so much. Thanks for taking the time, because I know you are always on the move, so it's nice for you to sit still for an hour or so and get some of the best out of you. So thanks again. Next up, we have from the left coast. He right now we've got him like holding him by his arms, but we're gonna break him free in the next few minutes. Laron Barton.
Hey, what's going on, you guys? My name is Laron Barton. I'm a writer, author of 2 books. First one is Straight Dope, a 360-degree look into American drug culture, and the second one is All We Really Need Is Love: Stories of Dating, Relationships, Heartbreak, and Marriage. I write essays about race, gender, mass incarceration, as well as dating. You can find me at Mainline Laron, and I'm just really stoked to be talking with these gentlemen. I always say, Dr. Vibe, thank you for giving me a chance to talk and work with black men that are smarter and more accomplished than I am, so I can always learn.
Good stuff. As always, good to have you. And from down south, Mr. Rodney Kellum from Atlanta, GA.
Hey, Dr. Vibe, this is Rodney Kellum, Fatherpreneur. I always like to begin by saying thank you to Dr. Vibe for providing an outlet for black men to talk about things that matter to us and those that love us. I am also an author of the book series What Your Name Is, book number one, What Not to Name Your Child, book number two, volume T-O-O, also seen on CNN Worldwide. I realize I don't do a really good job of tooting my own horn, so I'm giving it a better, you know, a better job right now. Inspirational speaker, husband to one wife, father to a whole bunch of babies, servant of God, and I am thankful to be here.
Excellent. And when he says a whole bunch of babies, they're from the same lady and it was in marriage. So I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah. No baby mamas.
Okay, there you go. Good stuff. Well, gentlemen, we are on fire tonight. And first conversation piece, maybe more people should sit with Colin Kaepernick. And this story broke within the last 24 hours. For those who are not aware, Colin Kaepernick is a quarterback for the NFL team, the San Francisco 49ers. And last night during the American National Anthem, he didn't stand at attention for the anthem. He sat down and he said that he didn't feel he needed to do that for a number of reasons. One of them feeling that he feels his country does not treat people of color fine. So we've took a vote, straw vote, before our conversation tonight, and guess who's going to talk about this first? I'm not even going to say the person's name. Just go ahead and start talking about it, my man.
All right, so this story is just okay. So many things to talk about the story. So I found out about this yesterday morning when I was at the gym, and you know, I thought that it was a hoax because normally athletes like Colin Kaepernick normally do not take a stand. So I checked around, looked at other sources, and pretty much verified that, yes, Colin Kaepernick, San Francisco 49er quarterback, did not stand during the national anthem. Now, as a lifelong Niners fan, as a San Francisco resident, this really resonated to me because as a black man, one of the things that I have not done in quite some time is sing the national anthem. I don't stand when everyone, you know, stands and puts their hand, where the heart is, because I believe that this country is corrupt, that this country was founded and operates on the system of racism, white supremacy. So for someone like Colin Kaepernick to recognize that, I mean, that's, and it's great to not only to recognize that, but just to make the statements that he made, stating that the reason why he will not stand is because of the acts of police terrorism and how he doesn't feel that everyone is being treated equally. I mean, this is really big. I mean, Colin Kaepernick is practicing an immense amount of black self-respect, and I'm just truly in awe. Now, of course, you know, the aftermath, you know, you had several white people, you know, chiming in and you know, and doing business as usual. White people started calling him nigger, started just essentially spewing all kinds of racial slurs to his way. Now there's two things that I really want people to pay attention. For starters, Colin Kaepernick is mixed. He has a white parent and he has a black parent, but white America sees you that even though you may have one white parent, they're always going to see you as black. So I want people to really recognize that, you know, if you're a mixed person and you're running around and saying, oh, well, you know, I'm mixed. No, at the end of the day, you are black. And secondly, whenever a black athlete sort of steps out of favor or does something that white America does not like, he's going to be immediately attacked with racial slurs. I mean, people were burning his jersey. I mean, it reminded me of when LeBron decided to leave Cleveland to go to Miami. So, you know, whenever you do something that white America doesn't like, you know, they're going to attack you. So just as long as you're playing ball, dancing, singing, rapping, whatever, you're good. Another thing that I found really interesting is that last week, Cam Newton made some comments. He said some things such as, oh, well, you know, the criticism that I've been receiving, it wasn't race related and America's past racism. Well, we all know that that's not correct. And, you know, I don't like to bash another victim of racism, but that right there, he's just being afraid. And young black children, we don't need another scared Negro. we need black people that are going to stand up and that are going to speak their mind and speak the truth. So bravo to Colin Kaepernick. And one more thing, Victor Cruz, man, you should be ashamed of yourself. The fact that he got up and said, well, you know, you got to respect, you have to respect the flag. I mean, that's ignorant, but he's a victim of racism. So, but anyway, bravo to Colin Kaepernick, you know, maximum display of black self-respect.
Okay, the guns are blazing already. Next up, Galen Bingham.
Yeah, you know, this was an incredibly touching story for me for a couple of reasons. Number one, Kaepernick is a member of Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated, so much love to my fellow Nuke there. And number two, I really kind of see this as very similar to what we just heard. I see this as, you know, someone coming into knowledge of who he wants to be. There's a difference between blind allegiance and earned allegiance. And, you know, there are several things that we all do just out of habit, just because it's just the way things are. That's just the way things go, right? And there are a number of things when you, you know, for many of us, if you sneeze, you say, excuse me, and you don't really think about it. You just do it because it's kind of blind, learned habit, right? But what Colin has done is he has said, wait a second, there are certain things that you've got to earn my allegiance. I'm not willing to just give myself blindly to something that doesn't seem to respect who I am off the field, or even respect who I am at times on the field. So many, many kudos. I think that this is a challenge to all of us to just think about those things that we do automatically, think about those things that we do blindly. Very often, if someone tells a joke and you just happen to smile, your silence is endorsing the joke. So just think about what you're doing. Think about what your actions and what your non-actions may or may not be endorsing. And I think if we can be more mindful, we can all advance whatever agenda, whatever goal that we might have. Last thing I'll say about this, I thought this was a very telling, given a topic that we discussed, I guess about a month and a half ago, about, you know, where are the Jim Browns, where are the Kareem Abdul-Jabbars, and I think you might be starting to see the emergence of that crew of black leaders coming from athletics, professional sports, and from the celebrity ranks, and you could begin to see those people emerge.
Good stuff, Alfonso.
Yeah, I appreciate the commentary, fellas. You know, I've referenced this before, that song that says something's happening here, what it is isn't exactly clear. Stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. I mean, I think, Dr. Vibe, you actually know that song, and I think you actually named it for me. But something really ugly is going on here in this country. We seem to have taken a turn for the cereal. And when I say cereal, I mean cereal racism that had not reared its ugly head in this particular way, although, of course, we know it has not gone anywhere. Somehow it had become latent for a while. And over the last, well, perhaps during the Obama administration, we've been seeing this real ugliness. And even now, with this inflammatory rhetoric coming from the political campaigns and the race baiting and the rise of what we're calling the alt-right and all these kinds of things. And I think that many people are waking up to realize that, wait a minute, you know, are we still in that place? And I think that the revelation from the young brother on the football team was just that. And it just say, wait a minute, stop. You mean to tell me the brother had his hands up and he still got shot? He had his hands up and he was begging not to be shot, but still got shot in this case? So we've got to find some kind of way. I don't know. I don't have the answers for it, but I do applaud this young brother for standing up and being counted in this way to bringing more attention to this issue. you know, I'm not a Pollyanna. I don't believe that racism is going to go anywhere, certainly during my lifetime and perhaps during anybody's lifetime on this panel. But we're going to have to find some kind of way to get along. And I think the advent of this social media has even furthered the boldness of folks, because you're not identified. You know, you're just a Twitter handle. You're not really a person. And you can spout these things off in anonymity. But if you actually said these things to somebody's face, then there would be repercussions. And so I think that we're trying to grapple with the technology and the fact that people can hide in cyberspace and sling this mud and hate without ever being identified. I don't know what to do about it, but I do. And I'll say again, I do applaud the young brother for bringing attention to it.
Nice. Alfonso, the name of that song is called, that you're referring to, is For What It's Worth by a group called Buffalo Springfield.
Okay.
That is the name of the song. Final comment on this goes to Rodney Callum.
So even though I live in Atlanta since 2005, I'm a native Californian. So a lot of my Facebook friends, you know, high school, junior high school, 49ers fans, Raiders fans, you know, and the like. And, of course, my Facebook feed lit up with F. Colin Kaepernick from some of my white friends, you know, and kudos to Colin Kaepernick for putting my black and brown friends. And I want to point out to, I've been thinking about this a lot. When we come on this show and we speak our opinions, we honestly take a risk of people that see us all as safe Negroes, I'm doing my air quotes, finding out that we actually have thoughts that they may believe are radical and they're very much opposed to. So you have somebody who, like Colin Kaepernick, one, who is, people say mixed race, but, you know, one black parent, one white parent, was adopted by and raised by a white family, has the audacity and the courage to speak something that it goes against the grain, that will immediately make him an enemy to many, vilify him to a lot of white America. He took a much bigger risk. Now, frame it right, he's made a lot of money already. I'm very sure if he's smart with his money, he could retire. But he most definitely has hurt his chances for any future endorsements. He's hurt his chances of being welcomed into certain clubs and places that can make him a lot more money. And he did it at a very high public financial cost. But when you're in a position like that, and, you know, we have talked about this in the past, where are the civil rights athletes of the 60s and 70s? And we are absolutely seeing another rise of that, what's going on. And it's taken too much death for it to take place. However, I'm very encouraged to see people willing to, in high places, being high places meaning high visibility, not being higher than other people, but high visibility where their voices can't be ignored by people of all ethnicities. So I'm so thankful that he's speaking out. You may or may not agree with everything he says, but I've always said that the conversation needs to keep happening. This race conversation needs to keep happening, because ignoring it obviously doesn't make it go away. There's a very famous interview that goes around the internet, you know, once a month, from Morgan Freeman being interviewed by Mike Wallace, I believe, saying, how do you get rid of racism? And Morgan Freeman's response was, quit talking about it. Out of all the movies I've loved with Morgan Freeman in it, it was the very first thing I've ever heard him say that I completely disagree with. This conversation needs to continue. Athletes and prominent African-Americans and brown people and people of color need to continue to speak out. Republican Senator Tim Scott, who is a dark-skinned black man, got on the Senate floor and talked about his experiences being pulled over multiple times in Washington, D.C., wearing the pin of the politician and still having police harass him on a regular basis just because he's black. These things need to be continued to talk about. To be talked about, because it allows people to stop sweeping it under a rug as if it doesn't need to be dealt with. And I can keep going on and on and on about this because there's so many facets to it, but I'm glad people in the prominent places that have a large voice, reaches many, are taking a stance, because at the price of losing endorsements, it's about saving lives. And I'm so thankful that people like him are speaking about it.
Excellent. First conversation piece down. Next up, we're recording this live on August 28th, and exactly a week ago, the Rio 2016 finished, and there was more than enough great things going on in the games, like Michael Phelps, Usain Bolt, American ladies gymnastic team, other things. But I think the story that may live on for a long time is Ryan Lochte. And of course, most people know about him and a group of gentlemen saying a certain thing went on when they were in Rio. They were assaulted, robbed, etc. And it all turned out to be a lie. So let's talk about Ryan Lochte's scandal and race. What's privilege got to do with it? First up, Galen Bingham.
Yeah, I mean, so white privilege, I had to look up the definition because I've got my own definition of what it means, but I wanted to be fair. So like most people today, I went to Wikipedia and I went to Google, and Peggy McIntosh define white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets. And for me, that really does capture it, because Ryan has the luxury, as we've talked about on the show several times, he has the luxury for people to expect the best of him. And you've seen all of his lies. You've seen, you know, this terrible situation be reduced to, well, this is just a great athlete having fun and burning off steam. If there were any other set of athletes, if it were members of the basketball team, if it were any African American whatsoever doing the same thing, they would not have the benefit of white privilege, and we would automatically assume the worst, that these were thugs, that these were gangsters, that these were hoodlums that were lucky enough to have this opportunity to represent their great country, and how dare they disgrace the United States of America and the flag that they wear on their chest. That would have been the dialogue. And I think anyone that would say differently is not being fair to what the United States really represents. So I think that this is a classic example of white privilege. I don't fault Ryan Lochte for taking advantage of it. I think if I had the opportunity to take advantage of white privilege, I think I might take advantage of it. But the reality of it is, there is a double standard. And for him to suggest and for him to believe that he is on the same footing as any other athlete outside of having this white privilege is a travesty. I could not imagine Marion Jones getting this kind of benefit of the doubt. I can't imagine Carl Lewis getting this kind of benefit of the doubt. I couldn't imagine any other African-American or athlete of color getting this kind of benefit, but yet Ryan does. And I think the article even suggests that he is not even Caucasian or 100% Caucasian, but yet he looks the part, and therefore looking the part comes along with it benefits. And I think that this is just a clear example of who America really is.
Next up, Alfonso.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Galen. Listen, I kind of go back to the stages of racial identity development. And along that continuum, you know, first of all, the first stage is that whites typically do not recognize the significance of race initially. And as you go down the continuum, as you go down and they grow culturally, we hope, that they begin to accept common stereotypes of people of color. But they still don't believe that racism is pervasive in society. And then after that, once they come to that realization, they become aware of privilege. And when whites become aware of privilege, it produces discomfort, guilt, shame, and anger. And so we oftentimes hear about the white guilt, right? And that's why you're volunteering in Africa. That's why you're volunteering in the hood. That's why you're down there, because you've realized at some point you've gotten to that level of identity development that says that, okay, I'm privileged and I'm guilty for it. you know, it, as I read that article, and I was struck by the quote, they were having fun. They're just kids. They made a mistake. It's part of life, right? And so as I was reading through that piece, I cannot remember at any point when an African-American young person made a mistake. And we were able, and we were so privileged to read words like that, right? And so much to Galen's point, you know, they would have been eviscerated, and black people would have been painted with a broad brush. You're all that way. We would have heard the words thug and gangster and all these kinds of things being bantied about, and a sweeping indictment of all of us. And so, I didn't. First of all, let me just say this much. I didn't believe him when it came out of his mouth. I'm looking at this man who had just experienced a life and death situation, allegedly. Now, pardon me if I may be naive, but had I had a gun stuck in my face with it cocked and pointed at my head, then I may have shown a little bit more emotion when somebody asked me what had occurred. And the fact that he was so cool, calm, and collected, it said to me, you're lying. And because of white privilege, we initially believed that lie, that nobody questioned the account when he said it until somebody from Brazil came back to give another account of the story. And so now the whole thing came out. So I hope, I'm just hopeful that white America will get to the stages, to get through these stages of identity development, and ultimately get to the point to where they can ally with us and just be human beings, because it's outrageous. I mean, it's crazy, but I didn't believe the kid when he said it. And plus, 32 years old, you're not a damn kid anymore.
Rodney.
So let's give a little timeline of this whole story, because it just started getting more and more outrageous as it went along. First and foremost, Gabby Douglas was being overshadowed by Simone Biles, which is an amazing rise of an amazing gymnast. So that story had taken over. But then, of course, they started, you know, going in on Gabby Douglas's hair again and her edges, predominantly black women doing this again, which is idiotic. So that story was taken over. And, you know, Simone Biles' accomplishments weren't really getting all the attention they should. And then this thing happened where, you know, they have the incident at the gas station. And then Ryan Lochte talks to his mother, lies to his mother about what happened, because I'm guessing he was too embarrassed to tell her the truth. So when asked, the mother was asked about it. Someone said Ryan was lying. And the mother said, oh, no. It's true, because of course your mother's going to believe what you're saying. And so because on the mother's word, this story started getting legs, and all of a sudden Simone Biles and Gabby Douglas and all the major accomplishments of the women's gymnastics team and a lot of other events were getting foreshadowed, not to mention that the floods in Baton Rouge are happening at the same exact time, where people are losing lives and property and having their whole lives changed. Ryan Lochte's lying behind gets all this attention. And, you know, maybe it's true because there's missing footage on the video. Okay, you see the footage. A guy did have a gun. But come to find out, they vandalized the bathroom. And that there's armed security at this gas station because it happened to be in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, which is one of the most dangerous places on earth. And that there's way more people being killed daily by the police in Rio de Janeiro than there are in any city in the United States. They're killing black and brown people in their favelas every day. But Ryan Lochte's lying behind is getting all the attention. Now, most white people that I know have a problem with accepting the idea of white privilege. Now, thank you, Galen, for giving a great example. But what you're seeing right in front of you is, let's say it's a double standard, so you can swallow the pill better, is that if it was not a white male, as Ryan Lochte appears to be, with dyed hair, blonde hair for some reason, he would not get the time of day or the shine or be shown in the way that it is, proven by the interview that happened with Al Roker and the white co-host,
when the white co-host found some reason to call him a kid, like well, my previous brother was talking about, called him a kid, giving him the benefit of doubt, and Mr. Al Roker himself, the nice Mr. Potato Head guy himself, I love calling him that because it's funny to me, was saying, no, he lied. No, he lied. And for some reason, the white co-host just couldn't accept that view from this kid who just made a mistake. This is what we're talking about when we talk about privilege. It's a privilege to have lied to police, lied to your mom, and still get benefits of the doubt. And leave the country and leave the rest of your teammates hanging to face face police questioning. You leave the country. How much more privilege can you have? So this man, you know, is way out of line. You know, he should have just fessed up to it, owned up to it, shouldn't have got his mom. That's maybe the worst crime of all. Got his mom involved, got her involved in a lie, embarrassing his mother at 32 years. I'm 34. I am not a kid. I'm as grown could be. He's 2 years younger than me, a 2-3-time Olympian, and he's a kid. This is crap. You know, why does he get this attention? I don't believe he should. And so, you know, if we could apologize to the women's gymnastics team and Gabby Douglas and Simone Biles for the crap they had to go up and all the people in Baton Rouge for being overshadowed, we apologize.
All right, final commentary on this one goes to LaRon.
Okay, so, man, this article really made me mad, man. I mean, for a couple reasons. First off, let's just address the term white privilege. If I had a magic wand and I can wave it and it could eradicate certain terms, you know, one would be turnt, one would be shouty, and the other would be white privilege. You know, I wrote an essay earlier this year talking about how I think the term white privilege essentially weakens and it just totally misrepresents what the issue is. There's no such thing as white privilege. It's racism, white supremacy. So white privilege just essentially says, oh, well, you know, I'm a white person. I woke up, I got all these goodies. I don't get shot in the street like black folks. You know, no one pulls me over and asks me to see my papers as if I'm a Latino, you know. And what we're not talking about is that how white people have gotten this power and how they maintain it. So white privilege is just a PC, PG way. It's a very non-offensive way of talking about racism. When I found out that Ryan Lochte was lying, one word came to my mind, Susan Smith. Now, you may wonder, oh, well, you know, LaRon, why would you say Susan Smith? She killed her children. Some of the fact is that Susan Smith, like Ryan Lochte, blamed a crime on a darker person. Rio has an incredible, it's a pretty dangerous place, right? So if you're a white guy and if you're trying to do something, you know, malicious, or, you know, you're trying to break some rules, well, why not blame it on the dark people that everyone thinks is savages, right? So that is a practice that white people have been doing for years. My friend Al Asoria brought up another person, Charles Stewart. I believe the fellow, he was in Boston. He blamed, there was this nefarious black person that robbed him. There was a young white woman about a couple years ago that said some Black Lives Matter protesters beat her up and carved the letter B on her face. I mean, this is a pattern that white people have been doing to us for ages, you know, and it doesn't, there's no privilege, there's no kind of ignorance, you know. White people know exactly what they've been doing because they're cultured to look at us like this. They're cultured to realize that, you know what, they're the lesser people, they're the criminals, we are not, so we can deal with them in any way, shape, or form. And Ryan Lochte knew that people would believe him because, hey, man, when in doubt, blame the crime on the scary black or brown man, because it's been happening for over and over and over. That's why you you have organizations like the Innocence Project that is on a daily basis exonerating people, particularly African-American men, for crimes that they were falsely accused and sentenced for. So, you know, Ryan Lochte played on an old racist trope, and he almost got away with it. I'm really happy that Brazil called him out on it. And, I mean, he's, you know, I mean, he is the epitome of a racist. I mean, I'm sorry. Like, I mean, just the fact that he can go to another country, just totally wreck shop, break things, and then concoct this story and blame it on non-white people. I mean, this is racism 101. I mean, white people do this stuff every single day. So, I mean, I wasn't surprised that he was lying. I mean, if anything, if you are an Olympian in Rio, everyone's going to recognize you, right? So if everyone's going to recognize you, then that means that police and security, there's going to be extra scrutiny on you. So if you're a criminal, why would you try to rob someone like that? I mean, he's not a quote unquote ordinary American. So that, you know, the story was shady from the beginning, and you know, he lied. I mean, you know, this is what white people do every single day. So I'm glad his lies caught up to him, but I wish we would call it for what it is. It's not white privilege. It's not people just, you know, getting benefits because of the fact that they're white. No, this is a system that operates and protects white people on a daily basis. So yeah, let's just eradicate the word white privilege, and let's just start calling it for what it is. It's called racism.
Okay, next conversation piece. And this is another interesting thing from that man named Donald Trump. We have a story here, Trump and the black vote. Is there a road to redemption? And Donald Trump continues to get the headlines, and at one point this week asking black Americans to vote for him because he said, hey, what do they have to lose voting for me? So our first person on this one is Alfonso.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I couldn't believe I couldn't believe that this man is actually asking for my vote and simultaneously cursing me out at the same time. That was just brand new for me. But no, there is no redemption. And no, we're not stupid. And no, you're not the first white person to insult us. And no, this is not our first time at the rodeo. And so there is no way in the world that any self-respecting African-American would walk into a voting booth and cast a ballot for this malignant narcissist. You can't simply just start reading from a teleprompter and all of a sudden now you've completely changed who you are, because you're now reading somebody else's words that they wrote for you, and that you're not going off the top and saying the most ridiculous things we've ever heard come out of the mouths of anybody running for president, let alone the nominee of a major party. And so when he said that the Democrats are taking us for granted and all these things, and how we've done so poorly under Democratic leadership around the country in our cities, and the democratically run cities or hell holes, whatever he called. And so I went back and I, you know, kind of checked. I mean, there have been 10 presidents in my lifetime, starting with John Kennedy. And so there have been 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans in my lifetime. And so I went back and did a comparative analysis economically. And guess what? We did no better under Republican leadership than we did under Democratic leadership. And so I'm not really sure where this man is getting his facts and trying to lay this at the feet of the first black president. But listen, let me stop for a moment and say and tell you what we have to lose in voting for him, what we have to lose in this man becoming president of the United States. First of all, he would be in charge of the IRS, the CIA, the DEA, the AFT, the FBI, and the military, in addition to so many other agencies. We've already seen how thin-skinned this man is.
that even if you suggest something about him, he's taking to Twitter in a tirade. And that kind of temperament is very dangerous for somebody with that kind of power. And so let's say he does become president and you disagree with something he says. Now you're under investigation by the IRS, the FBI, everybody else. And so who's going to stand up to that? Where will the opposition come from if this man is imbued with that level of power, right? And so what's to stop him from declaring martial law in Chicago and D.C. and Baltimore and Oakland, you know, in these hellholes? Because if you're going to be the law and order president, then you declare martial law, and then and so now you Negroes got to be off the street at 6 o'clock. You go to work, you come home, you go to the grocery store, and you go home, and you don't come out until we say so. And you've got armed troops on the street. Now I know that sounds kind of wild, but if you're the law and order president, and you're going to all of a sudden clean these things up, then that's the only option you have. Further, can you imagine Donald Trump with 2 or 3 Supreme Court nominations? What is at stake is our voter rights, many components of the Civil Rights Act, meaning that now you go to apply for the job and there are no safeguards anymore because they don't have to consider minorities and women and LGBT or anybody else. They can now discriminate freely because all of what we have fought for will be overturned if this man has an opportunity to appoint members of the Supreme Court. We will effectively be back in 1963 before we know what has happened to us. And so there is far more at stake than meets the eye. All right. So, you know, we have to be mindful and we have to think critically about how valuable this vote is and how dangerous this man is.
Next up, Rodney.
So I'm going to say something that may seem, I don't know, outrageous, is that Donald Trump didn't actually appeal for the black vote in what he said. What that man did was say what he was told sounds like an appeal to the black vote. All he did was say things that his supporters who want black people to stop bashing him needed to hear. It's really confounding and dumbfounding to me how masses of people can be controlled. So let me just make a point that I regularly make about when it comes to the Republicrats. So black folks, I urge you, I implore you to no longer just vote one way, Republican, Democrat, or however you've been voting for your remainder of your life, just because grandma and grandma voted one way, and truly make candidates earn your vote. But what came out of that man's mouth, it's very obvious that nobody respects us, Democrats nor Republicans, enough to make concerted efforts to speak to us on an intelligent level, to us, directly to us, and not take it as a point and a chance to attack their political opponent. I've never heard that consistently or eloquently by the majority of Democratic or Republican nominees from many state and above offices. So I would like to say, take this opportunity to look at a third and fourth option. Maybe it's too late to really, you know, galvanize a mass number of people, but if 300,000, 400,000, 500,000, 1 million black folks say, you know what, I'm not going to vote this one way just because, I'm going to register as an independent and force people to introduce policies and speak to us in a way that's respectful and intelligent and say, you know what? No one really has addressed your specific issues. Every time you guys come up with something, someone else hijacks your movement. Right now, the LGBTQ movement has hijacked the Black Lives Matter and the Black agenda, saying, us too at the same time. And I know this is getting off topic just a little bit, but I got to make this point. There's never been an economy based on the backs of LGBTQ people. So until that happens, stop trying to hijack black civil rights. Please stop, period. That's just from my heart. But when it comes to voting and getting people to really take us seriously, we have to organize and come up with at least five things that we all agree on and say, hey, Mr. Candidate, Mrs. Candidate, how are you going to address these issues? If you can come up with real policies to enact, or we're going to vote you out, we're not going to vote for you. That's the way I believe we've got to start looking at this, because then you get these people like Donald Trump who don't care, really don't care. Hillary Clinton doesn't really care. Look at her track record. Look at her voting record. Look what she supported, you know, mass incarceration. They don't really, really, truly, honestly care. Not really. They care enough to say the right things to get elected, and then they do the agenda that they're told to do when they get in the office. So you have to take back the power and do it with your brain and with your dollar.
Next up, LaRon.
Okay, so Donald Trump, man. You know, if I were a betting man, I would say he has a 30% chance of getting a substantial black vote. I think that black people some black people are really starting to wake up to the fact that, you know, Hillary Clinton is, I mean, she's a racist just like Donald Trump is. I mean, it's funny because, you know, people say, oh my God, I'm so afraid of Donald Trump. You know, he's going to decimate black America. But Hillary Clinton's done that, though. I mean, the mass incarceration rate that the United States is in, it would not be where it is if it wasn't for the Clinton's policies. I mean, the fact that she was endorsed and she had a lobby for a private prison organization. I mean, that's something to be said. I mean, the Clintons, they were responsible for mass incarceration as well as gutting welfare. And with that, also starting the three strikes law. So, I mean, those three things really took a toll on black America. Nevertheless, black people are historically voting Democrat, which unfortunately is going to keep going, because I mean, Donald Trump, he's such an extreme guy, right? I mean, you know, again, I've said it on this program before, and I'll say it again. I think Donald Trump is the most overtly racist politician I've seen in my lifetime. I recently wrote an essay where I compared Donald Trump to Rockwell of the American Nazi Party. With that being said, what Donald Trump said at that rally, I mean, he wasn't lying. I mean, like, black people are worse off than they were 8 years under a black president. I mean, let's take a look at our unemployment numbers. Let's take a look at our home ownership. Everything has gone down. I mean, HBCUs are being attacked. Our voting rights are under attack. I mean, the fact that black people are killed like sport by police officers on video at high numbers. I mean, all this stuff is happening under a black president. So, you know, sometimes the messenger may be not your favorite person, but the message that Donald Trump was giving you, I mean, I would say would be fairly accurate. Now, I think that because that Donald Trump, you know, started the whole birther not nonsense, because he has said inflammatory things about Latinos as well as Muslims. I mean, black people historically, we're a group that, you know, if we see one group being, you know, crapped on, we're gonna take up sides with that group. So I don't think Donald Trump has too much of a chance of getting the black vote, and it's a shame, because we're going to be voting for a woman that, I mean, gosh, like, this woman called us super predators, man. I mean, told us that we have to heal. I mean, that's some stuff that you would tell a slave. But, you know, people are like, well, you know, if we don't vote for her, Trump is going to get in. I'm going to be honest here. I don't think I think we're at rock bottom right now. Right. I mean, with the shooting of Corrine Gaines, where the police were trying to kill her, I think the son was like less than 3 years old. I mean, they're trying to kill kids. I mean, they killed Tamir Rice in less than 10 seconds. So I don't know how bad it can get. I mean, it's. I think we have to, as Rodney says, we have to start looking at other options, man. I mean, we have to start looking at a third party. Myself, I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton, you know, like, and I'm not voting for Donald Trump either. Like, that's just not logical. But I am voting for Jill Stein because I think that at some point we have to start that revolution of voting for a third party, because business as usual can't keep continuing. Because if it keeps continuing, then we're going to be in the same spot 20 years from now. And as someone that is an older black male now, my duty, my job is to make sure that the new generation is better off. So, you know, just as, you know, Rodney was saying some real stuff, make them earn your vote. Just don't vote for Clinton because she's dancing with Roland Martin and he's kind of low-key cooning. I mean, just you guys, like, so what, she comes to a black church? What about the fact that so many black fathers are incarcerated? You know, when we talk to her, we're not even asking the right questions. So I'm just asking you, black, Latino, Asian, white people, think about who you're going to vote for before you vote.
All right, final commentary on this one goes to Galen.
Yeah, well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got a feeling that something just ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'm going to get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, and here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Here's the deal. Trump is not qualified to lead the free world. He's not qualified to lead America. He's not qualified to lead a business. He can't even hold up his part of a successful marriage. He lacks the temperament, the foresight, the insight, and the ability to develop and maintain long-term relationships. A President Trump would compromise compromise our global standing as an economic and a military superpower. My daughter's future will become less determined by her aptitude and more determined by those who Trump has emboldened to give in to their darker beliefs about race. Although you can't control what people think about race, the government can and should protect against racist opinions becoming the rule of law. There is absolutely no way that the United States can elect a President Trump and still claim any type of moral superiority anywhere else in the world. I don't know how we're continuing to do that when there's genocide going on at home, but there would be absolutely no standing whatsoever anywhere else in the world with a President Trump. And I'm not even talking about the African-American situation. I'm not even talking about the black experience. I'm just talking about his ability to represent me as the president of my country. There is absolutely no way he can go to any country anywhere in the world and tell them that their laundry is dirty. So that's kind of my position on it. I'm really passionate about this thing because I really do own my position as a student of leadership, and this dude has not led anything. He has not successfully achieved anything whatsoever. The hardest thing in the world to do in business is to turn nothing into $1 million. The easiest thing to do in business is to turn $1 million into $40 million, and that's what he's done, and he hasn't even done that. He hasn't shared his tax returns. We don't know how much money he has. We know how much money he's claimed that he has, but we don't know how much money he actually has. He hasn't even represented the conservative views to the point where the Republican Party had to pull him aside after giving him their nomination to say, hey, look, this is what we stand for. He was not talking to us. He was not talking to me when he was saying that he wants my vote. He was talking to, was said earlier today, he was talking to the white people that don't want their candidates saying mean things about other people. That's who he was talking to. So there has been a lot of question on social media around, would you rather have someone who's going to be overt with their racism, or do you want someone who's going to be undercover with their racism? At this point, I want you to have enough respect to me to lie to me. At least lie to me. At least say, I'm concerned that if I tell Galen the truth about what I want to do to him, he's not going to give me his vote. At least lie to me. And Donald Trump doesn't respect me enough to even lie to me. So there is absolutely no way that the American public can elect a President Trump and have any kind of moral standing whatsoever anywhere else in the world.
All right, gentlemen, keep it going. You're on point as always. Next conversation piece. People say they approve of interracial couples, but studies uncover bias. So first up on this one, Rodney Kellum.
So growing up in California, it was very, you know, a lot of very mixed people, whether it be black and white, Asian, Latino. It was pretty regular to see mixed people. So having lived on this earth for 34 years, I've seen both sides of what they're talking about. So if you're walking down the street and you talk to 20, you know, white people with white families, husband and wife teams, you know, you okay with interracial dating? The majority on the street would say, oh, yeah, love who you love, you know, the right political things. But at home, in a family situation with other family members that look like them, the truth would come out. And they would say, you know, we would prefer that you married somebody white. And you can interject all the different reasons you want, from them being racist to actually being in fear of racism for their grandchildren. There's many, many reasons. But I would like to go a step further and to say that's the truth for most people. They focus on the black and white interracial, I hate that word, saying race, but I like to say ethnic, multi-ethnic couples, because races mean species, we're not different species. But again, they focus on black and white inter-ethnic couples. And that's where people have the most problem with. And that just points to the issues that LaRon always likes to point out and does it correctly. Of racism. It is a system, it's an economic system, and reinforced by false beliefs and sciences, and it's perpetrated all the way down the line. Now, I remember my mom took me to the side. I had a white girlfriend, I had a couple in high school because it was California, and it was a thing to do. And she loved the girl, she had no problem with it, but she was just openly honest. She said, you know, I'll prefer you to be with a black woman. And this is the sentiment, I think, that happens in most homes. The reasoning may be different, but it's the honest opinions and beliefs and desires of most families. You know, black women would love to see their black sons marry a black girl. White women would love to see their white sons marry a white girl. Interject your own reason. I would say, coming from a black household, you know, married to a black woman, raising black children, I would say if there's a difference when it comes to maybe encouraging black men to be with black women more than any other ethnicity, because there's so much healing to do, left to do in the black community. And truth be told, black men, nobody's going to help our black women heal better than us. Now, when it comes to other ethnicities, I'm not the expert on other ethnicities because I'm not one. I'm a black man. I happen to be a light-skinned black man, but I'm a black man. You know, my grandmother's Native American. My grandfather was in an inter-ethnic relationship. I didn't know my grandma wasn't black until I was like 20 years old. I thought she was mixed, but she's Native American. But all that to say is that I think that there's different reasoning when it comes to a white parent wanting their white child to only marry another white person. There's the racial element. There could be hate. There could be bias. These are the things you have to take into account when you're listening to a white person and even an Asian person, because they're very protective of their culture. Jewish people, the same. They're very protective of their culture for whatever reasons they are. I'm not going to sit here and say I know all the exact reasons, but I know there's many. And when it comes to this, it's usually a racial bias. There's usually racial, sometimes ignorance and racial prejudice involved, but it's the truth. people on the street will say one thing, but at home say something completely different.
All right. Next up for conversation on this one, LaRon.
Oh, man, interracial dating. Well, this piece was really interesting because, I mean, it pretty much kind of reinforced what I thought as far as how, you know, whites look at interracial dating, you know, specifically between a black man and a white woman. I mean, the feelings of disgust, of hatred, et cetera, that goes back. You know, back in like slavery. I mean, I don't know if it's the fear of the black penis or if it's because many don't feel that they're virile enough. But you know, I've heard comments from my friends that, you know, say, hey, you know what, like when I was with this white guy and, you know, he would see me talking to a black guy, he would freak out. And she ended up basically saying, like, later on is like he felt that he could not compete with the black man. I mean, it's in this society of racism, white supremacy, you know, no one is put on a pedestal higher than the white woman. I mean, pretty much like most, if all racial acts, you know, rather be, you know, war or laws or anything like that is created on behest of protecting the sanctity of the white woman. I mean, we can go from, you know, from black men being murdered to black men being falsely accused of rape. Just, I mean, you know, laws of just interracial dating. I mean, it was the fear of, you know, once the black man got a hold of the white woman, she would not come back. I mean, I had a friend of mine that told me that, you know, she's a white woman. She told me that, you know, when some of her dates found out that she used to date black men in the past, they would become disgusted and they would not want to date her anymore. So, I mean, it's, you know, these thoughts of disgust. I mean, this, you know, again, I mean, this is a pathology within white culture. I'm in a interracial relationship. My queen is Latina. And for me, I mean, I'm one of those guys, man, that, like, you know, love who you love. However, there is a humongous cultural component to it. And the fact of the matter is it, you know, you're going to, at some point, you know, you're going to have to teach the person about your culture, you know, and there's going to be these uneasy questions that you're going to have to answer. And, you know, some people just don't want to deal with it. You know, some people are just like, hey, man, you know what? I feel really, really comfortable with just dating my own. And I'm not knocking that, dude. I 150% understand that. I mean, you know, there are times where, you know, it would have been easier with a black woman, but, you know, but I love my lady. I mean, I would just say to anyone that's, you know, in an interracial relationship, I mean, it's not going to be easy, you know, especially in this highly racial environment that we're in now. I mean, you know, but, you know, with all that aside, this study really did not prove anything new. I mean, again, you know, it's one of those things like where, you know, when you're dating a white person, you're going to get the looks, you know, you're going to get the sneers, and it keeps on happening because, you know, as Rodney said, I mean, you know, this is the system of racism, and, you know, nothing's more valued than the white woman in this system. So.
Okay, next up, Galen.
Yeah, you know, when I read this article and I think about what it's talking about, I tend to think about some of the other research that you might hear about, where if you interview someone or 100 people and ask them, would you rather eat healthy or would you rather eat fast food? Everyone would say, I would rather eat healthy. but they'll leave the interview and they'll go to McDonald's, right? That's just kind of what we do. We always have this better view of what we would like to see than what we're actually willing to do, right? So this just kind of fit into that category. So the second thing I thought is, God is probably laughing at this and like saying, really, you know, I put you guys on this planet. I gave you one real commandment, and that is to love each other and to love me. And you guys are grappling over this, right? So that was like my second reaction. And then my last reaction is usually, and I had kind of I wouldn't say visceral, but I had a strong reaction to the word disgust in the article. And usually when people have any kind of strong reaction like that to someone else or something that they see, it says more about the person than it does about the subject or the target of their disgust. There's something that they're viewing that's giving them a view of themselves that they don't know how to process. And they then attribute that feeling to the people or to the subject that they're looking at. And I think that's what's going on here. The reality of it is, anyone looking for a mate, anyone looking to date someone, you would do well to try to find someone that you've got things in common with, that they can understand you, that you can understand them. And when you are from a different ethnicity, that challenge goes up because that's yet another thing that you've got to see if they understand you and if you understand them. And there are going to be challenges beyond that, but you know, that's an additional challenge that my wife and I never really had to talk through. We had to talk through a couple of other things, but not that one. I think that this is, I don't want to say a non-issue, but because it is an issue, but it shouldn't be an issue. I think here in America, we continue to struggle with this concept of hypocrisy between who we say we are and who we actually are. And I think that this is just another example of that.
Okay. And Alfonso.
All right. I think it's pretty much been said. I just have a couple things to add here. And I think Galen ended on this point. I mean, what we say is what we aspire to be. What we do is actually who we are, right? And, you know, I've had a couple instances, and this, you know, and it kind of goes both ways. I was in St. Louis, and I was sitting at a bar talking to a white female friend. Nothing going on between us, just friends out for a drink. And there was this sister sitting at the other end of the bar who glared at me, and I could read everything that was in her mind. I mean, it was a glare that burned through my soul as if to say, why are you sitting and talking with this white woman? You know, of course I didn't get up and ask her if I could help her, or, you know, what the hell are you staring at me? You know, it was just one of those things. And, you know, it's, yeah, you know, and another instance, I was in Baltimore. I was on a boat trip down the Chesapeake Bay. And I was talking to yet another white woman, a colleague, worked with the school district there. And I was confronted, literally confronted by a sister who said, I thought you were cool. I thought you were somebody I could deal with. I thought you were this. I thought you were that. Look at who you're talking to. And, you know, I just looked at her. And I just shook my head and I thought, you know, this is outrageous. This is ridiculous. We need to get ourselves out of people's relationships, get our heads out of people's crotches, get our head out of people's bedrooms, and mind your own business. I mean, I just can't imagine. It boggles my mind. It seems to me, though, that people are more averse to black and white relationships than they are to any other mixture, the Latino and white, or the Middle Eastern and white, or the, you know, whomever, Asian and white or whatever the case may be. But there seems to be another level at which it gets moved up to, if you will, that if it's an African-American and a white person. I don't have the answers for all these issues. I know that we're dealing with them. I'll continue to deal with them as best I can. But frankly, you know, I don't care. Yeah, you know, I'm gonna love who I love. I'm gonna date who I date. I'm gonna marry who I marry, and if anybody confronts me about it, I'll respond appropriately. That's my commentary.
Okay, next up, and sort of carrying on from the last conversations we had on social media, as in life, why people are way less likely to talk about race. So this is definitely focusing on the whole area of how open people who are not of color are willing to talk about racism online. So first off on this conversation piece, LaRon.
This was a really good piece. I mean, I'd actually seen this a couple weeks ago. And it's one of those things where, again, you know, I'm sounding like a broken record, but, you know, since we live in a system of racism, white supremacy, I mean, whites feel like, okay, this is the way life is supposed to be. I mean, like, you know, all this racial strife, I mean, it's being caused by the black people, by the Latino people, by the Asian people. And just, you know, that stuff that, you know, doesn't really concern me because it doesn't really affect me. I mean, I don't think that it's ignorance. I think it's more of an apathy. I think that it's more of a, I don't care. I feel like that white people don't have to worry about being a Trayvon Martin or being a Jordan Russell Davis. You know, they don't have to worry about being a Corinne Gaines. You know, they don't have to worry about jobs turning them down because their name is Jose. You know, they're going to get great home loans. They're going to always have the same voting rights. I mean, they're not going to live in food deserts. So just it's like most white people are probably like, look, hey, you know what? That has nothing to do with me over here. I don't care about it. I don't want to read about it. And I'm just going to move on with my life. And I mean, knowing what I know about the system, knowing what I know about, you know, whites and blacks, I'm not surprised by that. Because again, man, I mean, it's one of those things that where it only matters when it directly affects you. And they feel like that these are black issues because the way that racism is framed is that, okay, well, you know, they have to be doing something wrong, right? I mean, there's no reason why the niggers should be getting mad when a cop pulls them over. I mean, the cop, when he pulls me over, he is just there just to check for my safety. I mean, so it's the way that race is framed in America, and it allows whites to have a sense of apathy and just insulated from all the problems that us non-white people face, because I mean, don't ever have to worry about it. When I think about a lot of my white friends on social media, right, I would say about a good 20% of them share racial stuff. I mean, and just most of them are just like, I mean, you know, they'll chime in here and there, but it's almost like they're just oblivious. And you know, I know that that's not true. I just don't think that they care. So, I mean, it's, you know, I don't see this really changing unless you have a bunch of Zachary Hammonds happen. If you have white people all of a sudden losing jobs left and right, then it'll become a problem. But until then, you know, it's just going to be some noise that they can just turn off. So.
Next up, Galen.
Yeah, you know, I agree with LaRon to a great degree and often get frustrated when I have to follow him. This, am my opinion, this is kind of a non-issue. You know, I had an experience when I was, I don't know, I must have been 17 years old, working in a grocery store, my part-time job in high school. And I don't know what I was talking about, but I was in the break room and made some sort of comment about something, obviously having to do with race or being African-American or something like that. I don't remember the conversation, but I do remember that one of my friends who was non-African-American made a comment that has stuck with me for all this time. She said, "Wow, Galen, I really hope you don't become one of those people that become obsessed with being black." And I thought that was odd. I mean, it's like, I'm black all the time, so what do you mean about being obsessed with being black? If you're black all the time, that's your existence. And social media is an opportunity for people to express who they are in ways that they might not have the opportunity otherwise. So if I express my concern about a Trayvon Martin, if I express my concern about an Alton Sterling, if I express my concern about voting rights or education in the public schools, although my daughter does not go to public school currently, if I express my concern about the funding of black communities, that's who I am. That's not me being obsessed with being black. That's me expressing who I am. And for it to be defined as black people talking about race or black people talking about, you know, these things that can be twisted and turned as a talking point in the political campaigns, I think is an indictment on who America, you know, the hypocrisy of who America says that they are and who America really is, because I'm just being me everywhere I go. And social media is just another avenue for me to be me wherever I go, however I want to express it.
Next up, Alfonso.
All right. Good conversation, guys. And listen, I'll just take off where I left off on the racial identity piece, because I think it's very instructive here in this case that once whites realize that there is some level of privilege, and I know LaRon does not like that term, there is a recognition of the possibility, of their own prejudice. And then they stop talking. And I think that's where we are here, that when there's a silence online and in social media, it is because there is a recognition at some point that, you know, I've been trying to tell myself that I'm not prejudiced. I just don't feel like I'm prejudiced. I know, but then you come to the revelation that I actually am in fact prejudiced. Then the silence and frustration enters in for being labeled the victimizer, right? And so there is no what we would call positive white identity, and I think that's where the alt. Whatever this thing is, what we're dealing with, the alt-right or whatever the case may be, trying to establish some positive white identity, but they're going about it in the completely wrong way by, you know, you can be proud of being whoever you are, but there does not seem to be authentically this whole positive white identity that we seem to want, that we seem to grapple on when we say we've got black pride. And as it relates to the online piece, you know, what we're dealing with here is what we call disassociative anonymity, right? And that's the sense of protection, compartmentalized self or invisibility, that you cannot be seen. And it gives rise to people making all kinds of ridiculous comments, racial or sexual or whatever the case may be. But, you know, I think that what we're dealing with is that folks are at a certain stage in their racial identity. They may not even notice that they're in that stage. And of course, on the converse, we go through our own stages as well, right? And so with whites, because they've never had to grapple with these issues in as much as we have to be, and as Galen said, I'm black and I'm black 24/7, 365. And what do you mean I'm obsessed, right? So
you know, white folks don't really think that way, but there is no sense of a positive white identity, and if that makes sense. And I think that that's what's kind of giving, kind of contributing to, you know, the lack of participation in these issues in social media.
And finally, Rodney.
So I dare to engage my white friends on social media, places like Facebook, where when I see the ones that do dare to make some outrageous claims and insert the most recent tragedy of a black young male getting killed. I read a post from somebody I went to high school with who happened to be a white woman who's originally from Canada, who immigrated to the United States when she was very young with her family. And she made some of the most blindly racist comments. It was Michael Brown. And, you know, calling him, he was a man, he was a thug, and this, blah, 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 blah. And I have a policy where if I'm going to engage in things like this on social media, my purpose isn't to censor anyone, but my purpose is to get the conversation going. And it takes having to call people out, tag them in posts, you know, write their name in it, say, but what are your thoughts? You know, this is what you said. Can you defend or expound on your point of view? And it's the only way to get them to talk. And even then, sometimes they were like, well, if the point of view doesn't agree with what I want to say, then I'm just not going to chime in. And what you know, Alfonso was saying is true. It's if you, the moment you acknowledge it is the moment you accept it as a white person. Like, you know what? At large, people that consider themselves white, we have a problem. And with how we're viewing things and how we've treated people, and maybe not treated people one-on-one, but the system that's in place that has benefited us and been to the detriment of those who don't look like us on a massive scale, maybe I have a part in this, or maybe I benefit from this. It makes you look at things in ways that you didn't want to look at. And I have the Bible, I've been quoting this verse very often. I have a whole Twitter series called Truth That Makes You Free, because the Bible says the truth shall make you free. And being made free is when you're made free from a prison you didn't know that you were in. It makes you free from a prison you didn't know that you were in. So when you're free from a prison you didn't know that you're in, you're uncomfortable. How dare somebody pull me out of this prison that I was comfortable in, living wonderfully in, and now I have to reassess everything. I have to reassess how I think and act and operate in life. And that's what you see, this cognitive dissonance about these topics, where the vast majority of white people stay away from it. Maybe they feel like they can't win, but maybe they just need to spend more time listening to people like Tim Weiss. I routinely quote him on this show. He's written books like White Like Me, where it helps people understand the basis, at least the basis of where you need to go to start understanding what's gone on and what is going on in this country. So I will continue with my policy. I don't like to, get in an argument, but maybe debate and conversation about these very difficult topics has actually produced fruit of having somebody that I know, a white man who lives in Georgia, reassess his views. So we need to engage our white friends and our white counterparts in these conversations, because they're definitely not going to start them. So it's up to us.
Okay, last conversation piece of the night. When fear of being a black man turns to fear for family and race. So first person to give final comments is Galen.
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting article. It seems like we always have interesting articles, because this cuts, for me, this cuts to the core of this black experience in America. And we've been quoting songs and records all night, so I'm going to quote one that my dad used to say around the house all the time. And the line that he used to say is, it's not what you look like when you're doing what you're doing. It's what you're doing when you're doing what it looks like you're doing. And that's from the song Express Yourself. And that's one of those things that
if you're in corporate America, if you are in a bar, if you are anywhere, and you don't have the benefit of white privilege, then you have to go through that experience considering how what you're doing is perceived by other people, right? So you've got to advance whatever cause you're trying to advance, but you've got to do it in a way so it will be perceived a certain way by others that might be looking on. And if you do have the benefit of white privilege, which we're seeing mainline from Mr. Donald Trump, you can just say whatever's on your mind. You can just advance whatever cause in any way that you want to advance it with no second thought to how it's perceived by others, because if they perceive it the wrong way, well, then it's something wrong with them. And this is a very real dilemma if you are a black person. I was going to say a black man, but just a black person or a person of color trying to do anything worthwhile in order to succeed for yourself or for your family. You've got to be ever cognizant of how what you're doing, what it looks like you're doing, right? And this has played out very real time with police, Black Lives Matter is talking about this very, very real time. We've talked about this almost every week, that I can be at the right place at the right time and still be shot because I look like I was doing something wrong or I was just in the wrong place. So this is a scary article, and it cuts to the core of what this black life experience in America really is. I'm fearful not only for myself, I'm fearful for my daughter, I'm fearful for my wife. But your last story, and I tell a lot of stories about my dad. My dad had, came up in the 60s and he lived through a lot of things and was a trailblazer in a lot of different areas that we get to take for granted today. But he said that the saddest day, the saddest memory that he has was when he was sitting around the table talking to my brother and I. My brother is 4 years younger than I, and he was giving us a version of the black talk. This is what you have to do when police officers come around. You got to make sure you do this, you got to do that, and make sure that your hands are visible and make direct eye contact. Don't move until they give you permission to move. And he was giving us the talk. And my sister, who happens to be 12 years younger than I, she was very much a small girl. She must have been 7, 6, 7, 8 years old, maybe. And she said, "But Daddy, no, that's not true. Police officers are your friend." And he said that was the saddest day, the saddest moment that he can remember, because he knew that he was going to have to crush this innocence that his daughter, that his baby girl had, and he was going to have to change that. He was going to have to break that at some point because it was a matter of life and death for her. And, just to finish the story, now my sister doesn't have that problem because he's a professional boxer living in New York. So, you mess with me, I'll stick my sister on you. So, but, that's the reality of the kind of life that we live as black people. And this article, I think, cut right to the core of it.
Okay, we lost Laron for us on the call, so we're just going to get him back, and he'll get right into his thoughts on this piece. So, okay, Laron, you're on for the last commentary, on the last piece, when fear of being a black man turns to fear of for family and race.
I thought this piece was from a guy who is just finally realizing how just constrictive and just how large the system of racism, white supremacy is. I mean, it's almost like he's realizing, wow, it covers every corner of the world, every facet of life. I mean, pretty sure that every gentleman on this call just kind of came to that moment of truth one day. And I also reached that point about
4 or 5 years ago, I was like, oh my God, like, you know, there's nowhere to run. I mean, you can't go to Canada. You can't stay in the house. You know, it's just everywhere. I mean, I understood where he was coming from. I mean, I can definitely respect and identify with his paranoia. You know, I mean, it's a thing where when you walk outside to go to work, to go to laundromat, you know, grab a burger, you know, meet up with friends. I mean, you know, you kind of realize that, you know, your life is on the line. And not only that, but, you know, you think about, you know, your family members. I mean, I often joke and say, you know, my life expectancy has risen because I don't drive. So I don't have as much interaction with the police as I used to when I was on the road every day. But, you know, now, you know, I think about my nephews, man. I mean, you know, what kind of world are they going to be living in when, you know, a 12-year-old black child can be killed for possessing a toy gun? I mean, it's almost like you have a sense of there's nothing that you can do. I mean, it's total helplessness. And so I can't really, I mean, if I could talk to him, there wouldn't be anything that I can really tell him. I mean, other than just, you know, you do what you have to do to survive. You know, it just kind of reminded me of a quote from the movie 25th Hour. I mean, you survive. And, you know, we're not getting any help from the government. You know, police have never been on our side. And money can only insulate you so much. I mean, you know, David Blake kind of, you know, he found that out. So, I mean, there's nothing that you can do. And, I mean, just, you know, say your prayers and just try to educate as many black folks as you can. You know, practice black self-respect and just be patient with other black people as well as other non-white people, because I mean, we're all victims in this, and just you know, do what you can to survive. I mean, that's, you know, that's what it kind of boils down to.
Next up, Alfonso.
All right, gentlemen. Okay, I really appreciate all of this commentary. Very illuminating. You know, we're guilty until proven innocent, while the converse may be true for others. They're innocent until proven guilty. And all it takes is an accusation against one of us, any one of us on this panel tonight, can be accused of something, and it is automatically true, right? Much like we started this conversation out to say that if the men's basketball team had vandalized something in Rio, right, before we heard their side of the story, they would have been convicted in the press, online, and everywhere else. And so this whole idea, I've been scared for myself and my family my whole life. It never stopped. I mean, we live in a constant state of fear about what could potentially happen every time we walk out the door. And we're going to have to find some solutions to this. But all we have to do is be accused of something. And I had an incident here in Denver a couple of weeks ago. I was in the library, and you have study rooms in the library. And I saw this white lady. She was packing up, putting her laptop in her bag. She was, you know, putting her papers together, looking as if she was leaving. So I stuck my head in the door, and I asked, "Are you wrapping up?" Just like that. She then turned around and snapped, "You should have not. There are other rooms over there," right? And then she said some other things, and I said, "Lady," well, she said, "and I'm staying," right? And so it was clear that she was staying only to be spiteful. And so I said, "You know what? All you had to say was that you were staying," right? And I closed the door. Next thing I know, the security guard shows up, asking me for an explanation. And the commentary from the woman was, I flung the door open and demanded that she leave the room. Now, I wanted to confront her, but she was already gone because she knew that she was lying.
And it only takes a lie. He found one lie. If had that been a police officer, then I'm not sure what would have happened. It was just a library security guy who happened to be a brother who then said, oh, okay, I get it. You're the big, scary black guy. Because I get that all the time. And so he felt some level of kinsmanship with this whole kind of thing. That, yes, I am terrified for myself, my family, and maybe all of these things in some circuitous way, in some weird way. All of these things may be happening to wake up a younger generation of young activists and African Americans. Because heretofore, I think that we've been kind of coasting along, taking all these things for granted, never having really had to struggle that much. And now all of a sudden it's hit this young generation in their face. Now, I want to know what they're going to do about it. Because the answers won't come from us who are older. It's going to come from the younger generation. And I would hope that the younger generation would at least seek our advice and counsel as to how to proceed and not be so arrogant as to believe that they have all the answers, that we've gone through some things and we've got some wisdom to offer you to lead, guide, and direct. But the answers won't come from me. It's going to come from those who are in the millennial generation.
And final commentary tonight goes to Rodney Kellum.
So the last time I was pulled over, which was about a month and a half ago, for a taillight, I was having some technical issues. I happened to be an Asian police officer. But before that all transpired and learned the reason why we were being pulled over, pull over to the side, pull out my wallet, put the car in park, turn the key, to turn the ignition off. My pregnant wife was complaining about, why'd you turn the air off? It's hot. Oh, I said, Crystal, I have to. And she's like, why? I said, just be quiet for a moment. And, after the whole transaction went down, not transaction, but the whole experience went down, and while we were being pulled over, was the Asian police officer let us go. We had the changing of a light bulb in our glove box. He let us go with the understanding that we were going to go right to the park store and get a fix, which we did. But my mindset when I get pulled over is different than, my wife and that of my children. I understand that I have to be, as a large black male who happens to be large, have to take extra steps to make sure the police officer approaching me feels at ease with my hands on the steering wheel visibly, window rolled down, automatically. I have to make sure he feels comfortable because I understand completely that the safety of my family could be at risk if I don't make sure this police officer feels safe. These are the things that, as black males, we have to live with every day. It's not new to us, but, it's almost like cornrows to Bo Derek. When Bo Derek wore cornrows back in the day, it became the new hot trend to white America. Like when the Kardashians wear Bantu knots, it's the new hot trend to white America. But to black people, to people of African descent, this is what we know. This is our experience each and every day of our life for the entirety of our life. So it's not new. It's not new to us. It's new to the rest of the world that can't ignore our truth anymore because being broadcast, the revolution is being televised. It's not the revolution, the information that leads to it is being televised on Facebook Live and Twitter and Facebook. The spark is being televised and it's new to the rest of the world, old news to us, but at least it's being talked about now. At least now it can't be ignored. Maybe now the conversations will continue to lead to some solutions. Maybe. I'm an optimist. I've always been on the side of optimism. I'm a person of faith, so I always have to operate this way. But to reiterate, to us, it's not new. It's a reality. It's how we exist. And that's all.
Okay, gentlemen, that is it. And for those who listen, that is another episode edition of Do You Know What Time It Is? It's on most Sunday evenings, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Black men giving their comments, thoughts, opinions on current events and news stories. Before we let the gentlemen leave, we will let them give their contact information. So first up, let's have Galen Bingham.
I'm right here.
Okay, go ahead, Galen.
There we go. Hey, yeah, before I get into my contact information, four things that I've encouraged everyone to do. Number one, define who you are. Don't allow someone else or the television or a textbook to define who you are. Number two, you've got to learn the game, this game of life, and it is a game. You have to learn the rules of the game. You should always, number three, expect an agenda. Expect that everyone else is playing this game to win by their definition. And then lastly, you have to set goals beyond what you can see. With that, this is Galen Bingham, Leadership Residue. I believe that every success, every failure begins and ends with leadership. You can reach me on Facebook at Leadership Residue LLC. You can reach me on Twitter at Leaders Residue. And you can reach me on the web at www.leadership-residue.com. And you can find both my books on Amazon.com.
Excellent. LaRon is having phone troubles, so I'm just going to give his contact information. He's on Twitter at MainlineLaRon, and you can catch him at the Good Men Project and a lot of different platforms, writing more and more and getting more stuff published, distributed on different media platforms. Next up, we're going to have Alfonso Porter.
All right, gentlemen. What another phenomenal evening with you. I do appreciate it. You can find me on Twitter at Vertex Press, also on Facebook at 1 Mile High Speakers. All right, that's the number 1 Mile High Speakers. Or you can email me at aporter@vertexlearning.com.
And finally, we have Father Panur, Rodney Kellum.
So, yeah, I'd like to end in the same way that I begin by saying thank you to Dr. Vibe for providing an outlet for Black men to talk about things that matter to us and those that love us. I would love to continue conversations on places like Facebook, Twitter. You can follow me at FatherPreneur. Please email me at fatherpreneurship@gmail.com and visit my blog, fatherpreneurship.com. And remember, there are two really funny books and informative books called What's Your Name Is, Well, Not to Name Your Child, What's Your Name Is, Volume 2. For some reason, my CNN interview from 2011 keeps getting shared on Facebook as if it's brand new. People never heard about it, but it's going around, so I might as well talk about it.
Excellent. I am Dr. Vibe, host and producer. Do you know what time it is? I'm also host and producer of the award-winning Dr. Vibe show. As always, I like to say, you're blessed and highly favored. You're a magnet for miracles and you're a solution for someone's problem. You can touch base with me. Best way is through the website, www.thedrvibeshow.com. Twitter at drvibeshow. Email drvibeshow.com. And you can catch me also on Instagram and Facebook, The Dr. Vibe Show. And remember, I host epic conversations. As always, I'd like to say you're blessed and highly favored. You're a magnet for miracles and you're a solution for someone's problem. God bless. Peace be well. Keep the faith and we will catch you soon. And remember, walk good.